The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We tend to think violent Islamic extremism is primarily a religious phenomenon. Of course, that was the last thing on the minds of so many of the people that were involved in this conflict, even from within the ISIS side. When you get down to the motivations, it oftentimes ends up being as simple as a job or security or food. And of course, that, in my mind, is the reason why ISIS ended up in control of Mosul. And it's the cautionary tale of what we need to be careful of in the future as well, lest that type of political vacuum come into existence again. But from 2004, 2005, we were talking about the same issues, the disenfranchisement of the Sunni minority and what that could portend. And that was 14, 15 years ago. So now we've been through two iterations, Al-Qaeda in Iraq and then ISIS, growing from the same cause.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 22, 2019. In 2014, the precipitous fall of the ancient city of Mosul signaled the sudden rise to power of the Islamic State, a group that would soon declare a new caliphate from Mosul's Great Mosque. 2 years later, Mosul served as one of the group's last major enclaves in Iraq, and became the site of grinding, brutal urban warfare as Iraqi forces sought to reclaim control, block by block. Last week, Lawfare senior editor Scott R. Anderson sat down with two journalists who have produced new works documenting the battle for Mosul, veteran war correspondent James Verini, who is the author of the new book, They Will Have to Die Now, and former CIA official Dan Gabriel, who recently directed the documentary film entitled Mosul. They discussed the pivotal role the city has played in recent Iraqi history and what the struggle over it may be able to tell us about the future of the country and the region. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 463, James Verini and Dan Gabriel on the battle for Mosul.
James, let me start with you. Tell us a little bit about your background in Iraq and what led you to write this book.
So my background in Iraq is not very extensive. I first went to Iraq in the summer of 2016 on assignment for National Geographic magazine. I went there at that time because it was the first time in a few years that journalists could go into what had been the caliphate, what had been Islamic State territory, and report on what had been going on there until recently. At that point, ISIS was in hasty retreat back towards the northwest of the country and Mosul and the Syrian border. And for the first time in a while, journalists could go into Fallujah and Ramadi and Tikrit and places like this that had been the caliphate until very recently and talk to Iraqis about what life had been like under the caliphate. So I went there in July of 2016 to begin reporting that story for National Geographic. And as soon as I arrived, it became clear that the battle for Mosul was imminently to begin. And that was important because everyone knew, Iraqis and Americans and the world knew, that the battle for Mosul would be the climactic battle of this war against ISIS, at least as it was being fought in Iraq as opposed to in Syria. It would be the climactic battle because Mosul was by far ISIS's largest holding. It was the crown jewel of the caliphate, five or six times the size of Raqqa, their self-proclaimed capital in Syria. So I stayed in order to cover the battle, which everyone thought would take a few months. It ended up taking about 9 months. So I ended up staying until May of the following year. But that was the first time I'd ever gone on assignment to Iraq.
Interesting. And Dan, I know you've got some background in Iraq as well, but from a very different sort of perspective and angle. How did that lead you both to approach this project and, frankly, to find this incredible footage that you use throughout Mosul?
Yeah, that's right. So our story starts just a few months after James arrived in October of 2016, and it does last through the fall of the following summer of July of 2017. But to your point, yeah, my exposure to Mosul came as a CIA counterterrorism officer. And I was there for a short period of time, 2004 to 2005. I had TDY'd up from Baghdad to work on a project there. So, you know, really when I was in Mosul, it was not the worst place in Iraq. You know, people would think back then Fallujah or Ramadi, that's really where the action was. Of course, that changed significantly. We've also had a lot of people ask the question, you know, why did you decide to sort of tell the story of ISIS around Mosul? In addition to the reasons that James pointed out, of course, it's on the border, but it's also a very diverse city. You know, to tell the story of ISIS in Fallujah, it's primarily talking about a Sunni story. But I think what we get into, and of course in James's book as well, Mosul is a patchwork of the modern Middle East. It's really a microcosm, a metaphor, if you will, with all the different ethnicities that are involved in the conflict against ISIS. And as we kind of tell the story, united temporarily with the foregone conclusion being ISIS would be defeated. But of course, what happens after that is the big question.
And the main character in Mosul in the documentary is this Ali Maula, this reporter who is engaged in this trek to kind of interview a high-level ISIS detainee and meets these other characters along the way. At least that's the implied narrative. I know there may be a little bit of a construction there. How did you encounter Mr. Maula and again, engage with these different characters in this incredible, you know, bundle of footage and information that you use to weave the story together?
Ali Mullah is a journalist in Iraq that had worked extensively as a fixer. James talks about fixers in his book, as a fixer for Western news organizations. We grabbed him in 2015, I believe it was, when we were doing the first season of a two-season TV show for Al Hurra, which is part of the Middle East Broadcasting Network under the U.S. Agency for Global Media. And what they wanted us to do is put together a 12-episode series, about a half hour each, focused on ISIS defectors. So this was a couple of years before Mosul came into play. At this point, the U.S. government had an interest in telling the story of people who had joined ISIS for whatever reason, but had made the decision they were going to get out. Because, of course, that's the message that we wanted to reinforce to the target audience and to convince them, look, you may have made a bad decision, but there's a way out of this. So 13 different episodes in the first season, 13 different people with different reasons for why they joined ISIS. This is all filmed in Arabic, all in the Middle East. We had folks from Morocco, a couple from Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, so really all over the Middle East. And then, of course, they had 13 different reasons for why they get out and how they get out. So it really is intended to be an instructive TV series.
Interesting. Very interesting. So, James, Dan mentioned the diversity of Mosul. And Mosul is, even in Iraq, a country of immense diversity with lots of different pockets and cities and environments, it stands out as a very unique city. You do an incredible job in your book digging into the history of Mosul and weaving it into this modern narrative about the events that you saw and that leading up to the events that you saw and describe in your book. Can you give us a little bit of a sense of that now? What is Mosul to you? What makes it such an interesting focus for the story that brought it at the center of this conflict? And what about its history has really led us to this present day scenario that you delve into?
Yes. Well, thank you for that compliment. I did go to great lengths in the book to try to explain to the reader the history of Mosul. And as a journalist covering the Battle of Mosul in 2016, 2017, I guess you could say I got lucky, if that's the word we want to use, probably the wrong word. I got lucky that it took place in Mosul because Mosul, as you say, has such a fascinating history, arguably the most historically fascinating city in the region. It's one of the oldest cities that we know of. We can trace its origins back 5,000 years or more. In ancient times, Mosul was not known as Mosul. It was known as Nineveh, which everyone will remember from their Sunday school classes and the Bible. Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire, or the Neo-Assyrian Empire, as it's sometimes known, round about the first millennium, the early portion of the first millennium BC, at a time when the Assyrian Empire was the largest empire, archaeologists believe, in the world, stretching from the Caucasus down to the Sudan and from Cyprus to the Persian Empire. And as the biggest empire in the world, with what archaeologists believe was the largest city in the world, Nineveh, as an empire, it brought in people from all over the region. And so its reputation for ethnic and religious diversity began then. After the fall of the Assyrian Empire, Nineveh became fell into obscurity. And then in the Islamic period, Mosul rose to prominence in the Abbasid Empire. And the Abbasid Empire, which at the time was the center of the Islamic world, and thus in many ways the world, was renowned for its diversity. That was why it was so successful, is because it allowed not just Muslims, but Christians and Jews and Zoroastrians and all manner of schismatics and smaller religions to live. And Mosul was renowned for its ethnic and religious diversity. Even up until the late 20th century, you would find there not just Arabs, of course, but Kurds and Persians and Turkmen and Shabak and Yazidi and many different religions. And even very conservative Sunni Muslims in Mosul were always very proud of this reputation for diversity. The diversity started to diminish during the Ba'ath period and under Saddam Hussein. And then, of course, when ISIS came in 2014, the diversity diminished a lot. ISIS's interest in Mosul was obviously strategic and a matter of prestige. It was situated near the Syrian and Turkish borders, and it was Iraq's second or third largest city at the time by population. But certainly ISIS was also interested in attacking the diversity of the city of Mosul. They knew that it was full of Christians, among others, and they wanted to do away with them.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that. You know, ISIS kind of comes in control of Mosul in 2014. And you describe, I think, pretty ably this kind of evolution, fairly rapid evolution, but a bit of evolution in how they approach the population on a variety of fronts, both the diversity front, things like smoking, things like that. Can you give us a little sense about, you know, the early days and then where that began to wander in regards to ISIS's approach to this diverse cosmopolitan city?
Yeah, so the thing to remember is that in Iraq, at least, ISIS was as much, if not more, a political movement as a religious movement. The appeal that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and other leaders in ISIS were making to Iraqis, specifically to Sunni Iraqis, was the government of Nouri al-Maliki, the American-installed prime minister, is a Shia nationalist government that has taken Iraq away from its rightful leaders, the Sunnis, the people who'd been ruling it since the Ba'ath regime. Nouri al-Maliki's government has taken the country away from you, Sunnis, and we ISIS are going to restore it to you, and we're going to restore the true Islam, Sunni Islam, to its rightful place of prominence in the region. So, and this political appeal made a lot of sense to otherwise sane and sympathetic Iraqis who happened also to be Sunnis. And when ISIS first came into Mosul, as when it first came into other cities, it did not carry out the depredations that it would later become known for in Mosul. It was not immediately doing public executions and forcing men to grow out their beards and cut their pants short, and women, forcing women to cover up entirely. When it first came into Mosul in the summer of 2014, ISIS filled in the potholes. It cleaned up the roads. It opened new markets. It lowered rents. It introduced a new city constitution that called for people to be nice towards one another and forbade the private ownership of weapons and this kind of thing. So in its initial months, at least, ISIS seemed to be delivering on its promises to Moslawis that it was going to end the violence and the chaos in the country and restore order and dignity to Moslawis, and specifically to Sunni Arab Moslawis.
Dan, let me bring it back to you, because you really start in Mosul after this initial period is over, and you approach the story that you're telling through the eyes of non-Muslawis, of Iraqis outside of Mosul, outside of the areas where ISIS was based, who are facing this kind of incursion. And you follow, I don't know if this was you or some of the press that's covered your piece, but a lot of people compared it, that I've read, at the Heart of Darkness, right? And you have Ali Mawla, who is like kind of like your Marlowe figure leading this kind of procession. And you approach the story through a number of these characters that really show these different narratives. Let me focus on one of these characters, a woman named Hum Hanadi. Who is Hum Hanadi, and why did her story appeal to you, and what does it tell us about the experience that other Iraqis were having with ISIS at this time?
Right. Well, in one word, Hum Hanadi is a contradiction, and that's why she makes her such a great character. Of course, in the conflagration that we see in Mosul, to see a female, let alone in an Islamic society, on the battlefield, but in Mosul specifically, to see a female in the role that she's evolved into, which is as basically a militia leader of her own small militia unit, it is a contradiction. We see her in the kitchen. We see her with her child, cooking, talking about her ex-husband one, ex-husband two, and her love for them, and recounting love poems, and recounting her just immense passion for life that she had, the life that she had with them. And then she's calling in artillery strikes, standing on the side of a Humvee, on the side of a Jeep. And I think it's that contradiction that makes her speak to the audience, and the cinematographers were able to capture, and really humanize her, and to understand the pain that she went through losing her husband, and how that pain evolved into, frankly, revenge, which we call one of the key themes in the film. You know, she's very upfront about what she plans to do with the people that she captures. She's interviewing a detainee, and she basically says, "You're in my hands now, until you meet your maker." So she's not messing around, and she's just, if you were writing the Hollywood version of Mosul, she's the kind of character you would write, but we didn't need to, because she's a real person.
And an interesting part of her story, as I think you mentioned, is that she is not of the same kind of sectarian identity as the group she's leading. She's leading, I believe, although I could have this wrong, a Shia PMF unit.
That's right.
But she herself is from a Sunni family, at least. It's not clear to me exactly. You know, she plays down that sectarian identity, the importance of that, even though anybody who's an Iraq follower knows that the PMFs are seen as kind of this harbinger of increased sectarianism, particularly Shia sectarianism, but also other groups as well, that arose out of the Islamic State conflict. How does that sort of identity, do you see that fitting into this story? Is that a common phenomenon, or is she really an exception in that regard? And is there a little bit of a narrative's edge here? Obviously, some of these engagements are being facilitated by the Iraqi government. Did that play into this, the role this character ended up playing?
Right. Well, you hit it on the head there. So it's facilitated by the Iraqi government early on in this process, in the battle, in the conflict, really. They made the determination that one thing they were going to try to play down was the sectarian differences. Of course, that had been influenced by Iran and what they were looking to accomplish on the ground. Hanadi makes reference to a salary that she's receiving. Obviously, that's not necessarily from the government of Baghdad, or maybe it is, but they're acting as an intermediary. She is part of the PMF ultimately. But what you're referring to, Hanadi, is trying to minimize what we clearly see in front of our eyes, which is the sectarian conflict that ultimately led to the rise of ISIS. She's telling us it doesn't exist. But yet we see and we hear other things as the film goes on, as we move up the river. And again, it's that contradiction. It's that kind of dramatic tension that allows the plot to kind of develop on that, because we've got kind of the government line, which is everything's going to be fine. Everybody's going to get together and get along well during this operation and afterwards. But of course, there's more to meet the eye. And when we just peel back the onion a little bit, look under the surface a little bit more, we get to the other characters that are saying other things. Sheikh Saleh talking about the Ottoman horde, of course, referring to Turkey and almost foretelling what we've seen in the past few weeks in recent events.
So, you know, Hanadi definitely views ISIS as this incursion, this kind of force that came and disrupted her life, an external power. But James, you focus a lot of your book really on another set of stories, and those are the people, the Muslawis who live in Mosul, who are there when the Islamic State comes in, and have a mixed set of reactions, often diverse reactions to it. And there's one family that kind of plays this narrative throughout your book, kind of comes at the beginning, at the end, that has this incredibly layered story that you kind of unpeel for the reader. And that's of these two alienated brothers, Abu Omar and Abu Fahad. Can you tell us a little bit about them and their story and what you see it as telling us about the Maslawi experience and the experience perhaps of other Iraqis who found themselves under the Islamic State's governance?
Yes, as you say, the reactions to ISIS among Iraqis, and specifically Sunni Iraqis, was very complex. It had to be. I met Abu Omar and Abu Fahad as they were fleeing Mosul during the early days of the fighting in early November of 2016. I met Abu Omar just after he'd fled his home in the eastern outskirts of Mosul, and he and his daughters were in a way station waiting to be taken to a refugee camp, where I later reconnected with them and where I later met Abu Omar's brother, Abu Fahad. It took me months and months of going to the refugee camp and visiting them separately, because even in the refugee camp, they refused to talk to one another. But it took me months and months of going to the refugee camp and interviewing them and speaking with them and spending many, many hours with them over the course of about 6 months to learn just how entwined their family had been with ISIS and to learn just how complex the sentiments and emotions and motivations were around the family's entwinement with ISIS. Both Abu Omar and Abu Fahad told me in no uncertain terms, more or less as soon as I met them, that they had both supported the entrance of ISIS into Mosul in June of 2014. They'd done this for the reasons I talked about before. They were both Sunni men who had been abused and degraded by the mainly Shia military and police who'd been in Mosul for years under the Maliki government. And they agreed with ISIS's argument that a Shia nationalist government had taken Iraq away from its rightful leaders, the Sunnis. They believed this even though neither of the men was really a xenophobe nor particularly devout. They both had Shia friends and Christian friends and others. But they both found themselves agreeing with ISIS's argument, political argument about Iraq, against their better judgment. And Abu Fahad in particular, I was struck by his sanity and his sympathy and just how level-headed he was. And yet it was a mark of just how desperate men like him had become that they saw ISIS as a viable political alternative, that they saw what was in many ways a sadistic death cult, you know, and a millenarian organization. They saw this as the only alternative to the government of Iraq. They were so desperate after years of American occupation and of corrupt and indifferent governance that they felt they had no other alternative. And even as they decided this and decided to throw in their lot with ISIS, or at least abide it, they also knew just what a crazy decision they were making, but they felt they had no other choice.
And of course, this story isn't just about one generation. They both also had sons who were of a younger generation, who were kind of adolescents or perhaps young adults as ISIS comes into power, and both had their own encounter with the Islamic State and its ideology that's a little bit different from their father's. Tell us a little bit about Omar, who's the son of Abu Omar, and Loy, the son of Abu Fahad.
Well, yeah, to tell that story, I suppose we also need to go on the other side and talk about the fact that by the time ISIS entered Mosul in the summer of 2014, Iraq had been living through one kind of war or another essentially for two generations, beginning with Saddam's invasion of Iran in 1979-1980. Both Abu Omar and Abu Fahad had been in Saddam's army. Abu Omar had fought, or at least had served, in Iran and in Kuwait, and found the Iran war kind of baffling, found the Kuwait war absolutely absurd, but of course he couldn't object nor abdicate. Abu Fahad had been the chief nurse in a military hospital in Mosul. And then, of course, they lived through the American invasion and occupation in 2003 to 2011. So by the time of ISIS's arrival in June of 2014, they and their families had been living through war and conflict and just brutal circumstances, the rise of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and of other Sunni insurgencies and of course, the Shia insurgency. They'd been living through this for a generation or more. Their sons, Abu Omar's son was Omar and Abu Fahad's son was Loy, their sons had watched all of this happen, and they'd watched their fathers become increasingly downtrodden and increasingly humiliated as they saw it. And I interviewed Omar at length. I never got to meet Loy. I only heard about him and then sadly saw the video in which he was executed by federal police. But I knew from Omar, Abu Omar's son, that this years-long process of watching their fathers, their families, and particularly their fathers, become so downtrodden and so humiliated by first Saddam and then by the Americans and then by ISIS, this had a great psychological toll, and it made them desire what so many young men in the region desired and worldwide desire, which is to belong to something of strength, to belong to an organization that gives their life meaning and seems to give them strength. And so both of them, Omar and Loy, were seduced by the ministrations of the Islamic State. Omar joined up only briefly. He doesn't seem to have been much of a natural soldier, and he doesn't seem to have wanted to fight much, though he talked tough. He eventually left ISIS and then was caught by the Kurdish forces in the refugee camp and was imprisoned. Loy met a worse fate. He had been involved with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, according to his father, and then became a higher-up in ISIS in Mosul and was fighting, it would appear, on the west side of Mosul when he was captured and summarily executed in the street by the federal police.
And this really brings in a theme that I think really runs beneath both of your pieces, something that Dan just referenced here. And this is about this experience of violence, cycles of violence, and the way it's used in certain ways. The trauma you just described, James, you know, you see in a lot of your characters. One that really stood out for me is the description of Abu Fahad's wife, who was killed at a checkpoint by either U.S. or Iraqi soldiers during the what we call, you know, the second Iraq war after 2003, and the impact it had on his children who were witnesses to that. That's still a very painful memory for them as this kind of, you know, residual impact. You know, you mentioned that in your book that many Iraqi soldiers don't seem to be wearing helmets. They've got a kind of fatalistic view about their own mortality. And that's something you actually see on display in Mosul, the documentary. You know, you have one of your main characters, this special operations soldier who you're accompanying, Captain Allah, never wear a helmet. And a number of other soldiers not really go with the full battle kit we expect of American soldiers, although some of his soldiers, it should be noted, did to their better health, no doubt. Let me bring that question to you, Dan, about the cycle of violence. One thing you talk about and you talk to Hanadi about is there's use of violence. She mentions that. She says, there's rumor about me that I boil the heads of Daesh, of ISIS. That's not true. But I do mutilate their bodies, and I take videos of it so I can show people that they don't have power anymore.
And she did tell a CNN crew that she did.
Oh, really? Interesting.
So, you know, I think she wants it to be, you know, perhaps ambiguous, but
what are the plays of, you know, the uses of violence that you saw throughout this story and how you see those echo out in intended ways and in unintended ways?
Right. Well, towards the end of the film, and one of the balances for the creative side of this was how much violence to include in this film. I mean, we have stuff from the dark web that most people haven't seen in terms of ISIS propaganda video, and it is so real that it looks fake because from what Hollywood's ingrained in our heads, there's a way that you look when you get your head cut off. But in fact, that's the fake way. And when you see it in real life, it actually doesn't look real because it's so different for whatever reason. It's just a mind trick. So one of the great editorial decisions here was to kind of find the right medium to show the barbarity of these guys, but not to denigrate and to be respectful of the victims, of course, and the audience. Towards the end of the film, we include some essentially cell phone camera footage of which we had dozens and dozens of clips that we had collected. And these are, you know, it could have been Loy on one of these cameras. This is footage that were shot by Iraqi PMFs or security forces or police to one extent or another. And they are more or less a summary execution without a judge, without a jury. A battlefield decision, justice rendered right there. And of course, all of the and trappings that go with the, you know, corpse desecration to follow. So, yeah, this is the type of violence that that just jumps off the pages of James's book, and it affects families and generations. James's point about the political reasoning for everything that we see here, I think in the West, in the U.S. especially, we tend to think violent Islamic extremism is primarily a religious phenomenon. Of course, that was the last thing on the minds of so many of the people that were involved in this conflict, even from within the ISIS side. When you get down to the motivations, it oftentimes ends up being as simple as a job or security or food. And of course, that in my mind is the reason why ISIS ended up in control of Mosul. And it's the cautionary tale of what we need to be careful of in the future as well, lest that type of political vacuum come into existence again. But from 2004, 2005, we were talking about the same issues, the disenfranchisement of the Sunni minority and what that could portend. And that was 14, 15 years ago. So now we've now been through two iterations, Al-Qaeda in Iraq and then ISIS, growing from the same cause and not being the symptom of it there.
James, let me turn the same question back to you, but I want to expand the aperture a little bit. You close your book with these really horrendous scenes describing what the Islamic State or ISIS is doing in the closing stages of this war. They've corralled civilians into mosques or into structures and that they're firing from, knowing that this is going to trigger large-scale casualties. They are consciously destroying cultural artifacts and by some accounts, targeting civilians. And this is playing into the criticisms of the U.S. military strategy at the time, some of which are certainly legitimate in terms of how they approach civilian casualties or maybe legitimate, some of which may not fully capture the extent to which there's a deliberate effort by the Islamic State during this period. Tell us about that strategy. And how did the Islamic State specifically think about violence in terms of its overall strategy and the impact it was hoping to have on Iraq and the broader region?
Well, I think I didn't get to interview higher-ups in ISIS, I'm sad to say. But my guess is that there is a diversity of opinions about violence and its uses in ISIS. In the most theological sense, people like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and before him Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi were supposedly steeped in the apocalyptic literature of Islam. This is to say the passages of the Quran and the Hadith and the commentary that surrounds them that talks about what the world will look like in the run-up to the end times, to Armageddon. And that essentially describes a holy war in which Muhammad will return in the company of Jesus, by the way, a giant war and conflagration that precedes the end times. So I think there were certain of the more devout members of ISIS who believed that the violence that was around them and the violence that they were committing was part of a larger narrative of the apocalypse, that they were actually, by committing violence, they were in a way priming the ground for the apocalypse. And certainly many have attested to this idea. I think there are also members of ISIS, some of the same members perhaps, or different ones, who saw, you know, merely the propaganda value in spectacular violence. They saw the psychological value in the spectacle of fearsome acts. They knew that ISIS was as much a virtual thing as it was a real thing, that it existed as much on the internet as it did in Syria and Iraq. And they knew that to perpetuate this virtual reputation it had, this absolutely fearsome reputation, they had to keep on committing violence and depicting and broadcasting that violence. When it came to ISIS's attempts to kill as many Moslawi civilians as possible and destroy as much of the city as possible on their way out, and surely most of them knew that they were on their way out, the explanation one got in the ISIS propaganda was that Moslawis deserved to die because they were essentially apostates for allowing their city to fall back into the hands of the Iraqi military, that any Moslawi who dared flee the city in the midst of the fighting was an apostate and deserved to die. You know, these are particular reasons to ISIS in Mosul, but they're not exclusive or at all singular in history. You find the same attitudes playing out with any theocratic or terroristic regime as it's losing its power. You know, the scorched earth theory that you found in Berlin in 1945 and in so many other wars and conflicts.
And that brings us to, you know, a story in the stories that are so difficult and have such dark moments. You both have little glimmers of hope kind of written in. James, you close with this really, I think, poignant, pretty beautiful scene of exploring tunnels underneath a destroyed mosque and uncovering a trove of Assyrian relics that somehow have survived the Islamic State, and kind of on this note about the layers of life and the depth to which they go and the extent to which their Mosul has found a way to live on in spite of what has been a violent history in some ways throughout its history. And Dan, you have this really fascinating conversation with Captain Allah, who's a pretty educated guy. I think he was a lawyer by training, had aspirations to be a lawyer, and said that, you know, in other societies, we've seen war be an impetus for creative thought, for political change. I take him to be implying. And that maybe, I think the implication is he hopes that'd be the case here. What do you both think this chapter has meant for Iraq? We've seen Iraq go through a tumultuous period. First, a conflict between the Kurdish forces and the central government shortly after kind of the end of combat operations against ISIS. Then a very controversial election with a strong populist element that led to the ousting of Prime Minister al-Abadi, who had led the kind of initiative here, the introduction of a new government, although with similar sort of political alignment, but new figures at least involved. And just in the last few weeks, we've seen this incredible wave of popular demonstrations of a different scale and type, and including a different type of violent response than we've seen of other sort of popular protests that have occurred kind of particularly in the summers in Iraq for the last several years. What lessons are Iraqis and Maslawis pulling from this experience with the Islamic State? And what does it mean about this next chapter in their history? Dan, I'll start with you.
Well, I think first and foremost, recent events tell us that, and tell most importantly Iraqis, that their future is going to be defined by what happens to the north and to the east and to the southeast, in the sense of what we see going on with Syria, Turkey, the Kurd issue, and what happens with the U.S. policy vis-a-vis Iran. You know, any conflict, of course, that the U.S. would engage in with Iran would be fought in Iraq. So I think the future of Iraq is the future of the region.
James, how about you?
Well, I'm kind of a pessimist where cycles of violence and their potential benefits are concerned. I think people can always continue to be violent towards one another and can always get more violent towards one another. There's this idea that you voiced that violence can inoculate a society. And if it goes on for long enough and is bad enough, that people will tire of it or see the futility in it and create political reform, create a better society. In my experience covering conflict in the Middle East and other parts of the world, I have often found that the reverse is true, that violence begets more violence and worse violence, and that people find a way of going on in that way for years and generations. In Iraq, Iraq is no more prey to war or violence than any of the rest of the world. It's just that there's been more conflict there recently, so we tend to think in that way. But the fact is, the world has always been mirrored in war and violence. Europe was mirrored in war for centuries until slightly more than a half century ago. And we happen to be seeing that in the Islamic world now between the powers that that Dan mentioned. In terms of Iraq specifically, when I left in 2017, in the summer of 2017, I was all but certain that another sectarian war of the sort we'd seen in the mid-2000s would erupt again after ISIS was kicked out or at least suppressed. I thought this because of the increasingly sectarian nature of the war against ISIS, the retrenchment of the Shia and the Sunni positions into militias and the militarization of the formal military. That sectarian war has not happened yet, but I wouldn't be the least surprised to see it begin tomorrow morning. The new protests that are occurring in Iraq are troubling, of course, and the violence with which they're being met is troubling. What is encouraging about these protests is that they began, and if I'm correct, are still centered in the south of the country, which is to say in Shia-dominated provinces and cities. The protest movement that arose in 2012 against the Nouri al-Maliki government was a primarily Sunni-led protest movement in places like Anbar and Diyala, and it was a direct reaction to Nouri al-Maliki's persecution of Sunni leaders and his neglect of Sunni majority provinces. The difference now is that the Iraqi government is still largely dominated by Shia nationalist interests in Baghdad. The protesters are also Shia, which shows that discontent with the government in Iraq and opposition to the government can transcend sectarian borders. I'm not sure that this is going to lead to government reform, but it is encouraging in the idea that perhaps Sunni and Shia can join in this political reform movement.
Well, I want to turn to one last question for you on this, and that Dan's alluded to a few times, which are this current events. You know, in the last week or two, since we scheduled this interview, we've seen another major turn in the broader offensive against the Islamic State or Daesh. And that is a decision by President Trump to pull U.S. troops away from the border between Syria and Turkey and the initiation of this Turkey offensive that's intent on deriving U.S. allies who had been involved in combating ISIS and in some ways still suppressing ISIS, at least by many accounts, away from the border. And that has led them to, among other things, cease defending several camps that had ISIS fighters and their family members detained in them, who now the, you know, location and current status of which in many cases is unknown. Out of curiosity, you know, you both have produced these products that give us this view that a few other things do about the Islamic State, its operations, its ideology, its origins, and its kind of evolution. What lessons can you pull from that in terms of we look at what may be a new chapter of the Islamic State in Syria and how actors that are intent on trying to prevent a resurgence, what lessons they should pull from the history that you guys have helped to document here? Dan, again, I'll start with you.
Well, in all likelihood, the next generation of whatever ISIS would evolve into is probably 6 or 7 years old, growing up in Masaka refugee camp about 250 kilometers from Mosul right now. And their experience, just as James explained, the experience of Abu Omar and Fahd is going to be colored by what transpires in the next weeks and months, what the Russians do, what the Turks do. Once again, this recurring theme of the U.S. betrayal that's so familiar for Kurds. So, yeah, I mean, this is a critical moment. I don't think it's an overstatement to say this is perhaps as significant a moment as when we decided to go into Iraq or when we decided to not negotiate the status of forces to remain. This is probably, you know, right up there with those two events. So for the future of the region, the next couple of months are very important.
James, how about you?
I think Dan will probably know much more than I about the political details on the ground in Turkey and Syria. But I think, again, it's important to look at this in historical context. In the minds of many Iraqis and Kurds, this with this sudden, precipitate, entirely ill-advised or not advised withdrawal of the president's from Syria is just the latest in a series of betrayals by the West and by the United States that in the minds of many Iraqis and Kurds began basically after World War One or during World War One with the Sykes-Picot Agreement that divided the region up between the Brits and the Brits and the French, and then continued with the abandonment of the Kurds after the war, and continued on in various forms until 2011 with the American withdrawal, which many Iraqis, including Kurds, saw as a kind of betrayal or at least a great abdication of responsibility by the Americans. So I can assure you that very few Iraqis and Kurds are surprised by Trump's move, even if they happen to be shocked by it. Of course, none of us should be surprised at this point in his administration that he would do something this foolish. When it comes to the resurgence or the possible resurgence of ISIS as a result of the American pullout from northeast Syria, actually, ISIS's resurgence or possible resurgence there worries me less than their emergence in other parts of the world, specifically Afghanistan, to name another war in which we've been mired for even a longer time, and most recently, Kashmir. I guarantee that ISIS will make itself known in Kashmir soon enough, if it hasn't already. The fact is that in northeast Syria, neither the Syrian military nor the Turkish military nor the Kurds want to see ISIS resurge. My guess is they'll find a way of fighting or suppressing it, if not as effectively as we might like, then certainly violently and brutally. But I'm more worried about where ISIS, such as it is, under a new name and new auspices, where it's popping up in other parts of the world.
Well, you know, as we look forward to this next chapter and the challenges it poses, when we are lucky to have these two works that you guys have produced for us, giving us so much insight into this experience and this kind of seminal turning point in the last conflict against ISIS around the city of Mosul. Thank you both for your work on this and for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to James Verini and Dan Gabriel for coming on the show. If you have a second, please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell. Jacob Schultz was your audio engineer this week, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.